Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's show is sponsored by Bob's Red Mill. With natural foods, they support organic, vegan, paleo, and gluten-free lifestyles. Learn more about their commitment to good food for all at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, welcome to We Dig Plants on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Alice Marcus Krieg, and my co-host is on a rooftop today in the blazing sun, so it is just me, and we actually have an amazing show. We're going to be talking with the head gardener named John Kuykendall from Blackberry Farm. And this is a full circle show for me because my father is from Jackson, Tennessee, and I married a man from just outside of Knoxville, Tennessee, in Oak Ridge. And I have deep roots in the Tennessee Valley. So very, very excited to return home and to get to talk with John about Blackberry Farm and seed saving and his new movie that is going to be screened this July at the Denver Slow Food Conference. We'll talk about that in a little while. But what I'd like to do is give a bio of John, and let's start the interview. So this bio is from the Louisiana Public Broadcasting website. John Kuykendall is a renowned heirloom seed saver, a classically trained artist, and master gardener at Blackberry Farm, one of America's top resorts. Since 1973, he has made an annual pilgrimage to Louisiana, where he has recorded the oral histories, growing techniques, recipes, and folktales of Louisiana farmers and backyard gardeners in more than 80 beautifully illustrated journals. He has saved and safeguarded rare varieties of the crops that they once grew and handed them back to the communities from where they came. Seeds carry with them more than the potential to sustain people as food. They are living history of the people who cared and tended to them and cultivated them and passed them down. I feel 100% total obligation. I am the caretaker, believes Kuykendall. This is what we're working to save. The history, the heritage, the way of life, the way of farming, the way of cuisine, everything to do that needs to be preserved while still here to be preserved. A Tennessee native, the 73-year-old Kuykendall is a true Renaissance man and a celebrity in a growing movement that places a premium on farm-to-table cuisine and locally sourced organic and heirloom food. He is a classically trained artist who studied at the Ringling College of Art and Design and worked as an instructor at the School of the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, and he is well known for his sketches of the pastoral landscape in which he works. For nearly 20 years, he has been the master gardener at one of America's most celebrated destination resorts, Blackberry Farm, in the Smoky Mountains of Tennessee. The 4,200-acre resort, working farm, and culinary mecca has been heralded by the world's most prestigious magazines, including Travel and Leisure, Bon Appetit, Forbes, Vogue, Town and Country, Southern Living, and Garden and Gun, among many others. At Blackberry Farm, John cultivates the property's 7 acres of farmland that supply the resort's award-winning restaurants with fresh-from-the-ground heirloom varieties of fruits and vegetables. In his role at Blackberry Farm, he has also become one of the nation's most important seed savers, locating, preserving, and sharing nearly extinct vegetable varieties, once abundant in America, and particularly in the South. It is the work of a seasoned detective, and while his efforts take him around the world, searching for seeds and beans and the cultural knowledge of how to grow them, what inspires him most is his annual pilgrimage to a small Louisiana community he stumbled upon 40 years ago. Drawn to the Washington Parish area as a college student in the early 70s, John forged relationships with local farmers in that community, where over the years he has served as a dedicated and beloved volunteer at the Washington Parish Free Fair and has painstakingly recorded notes, documented stories, and created beautiful sketches in volumes of moleskin notebooks, which detail an agricultural way of life that is at risk of being lost across our nation. So welcome, John. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so very much. It's an honor to be with you.
Well, it's an honor to talk to you. And like I said, I have deep roots in Tennessee, and I think there is a possibility that you might know my dad's cousin was the head of the Women's Farm Bureau for the state. Her name is Linda Davis.
Yes, I know the name well.
Yes. So and she now runs a farm out in Jackson that is like a camp for kids, and that's kind of her retirement job. But Linda has been a real mentor to me, and I also got married at the Museum of Appalachia, not too far from Blackberry Farm.
That's one of my favorite places.
Yeah,
John Rice Irwin's museum. It's a great place to be.
He's a great man. When I met him for the first time, he looked right at me and he said, "You're Irish, but you're Black Irish."
I'd say he pegged you pretty well.
Yeah, I think so. So let's get started, John, with how you got started. Tell me about 1959 and the Henry Moll seed catalog.
That was a day in March 1959 when I was exploring the old abandoned Ebenezer Railroad Station west of Knoxville. And I found a pristine copy of the 1913 catalog, and that catalog was filled with beautiful illustrations, engravings of all the rare varieties. And I remember thinking at the time, these are really unique varieties, and I began to wonder where you could find them, if they were still around.
Right.
You know, in 1959, we had computers, but they were probably about the size of the studio you're sitting in.
Yeah, exactly.
We didn't have our cell phones and laptop computers we have today, so there was no formal networking, no organizations such as the Seed Savers Exchange that I'm a member of today.
Right.
So we had to, it was pure luck, really, to find anything. But today, you fast forward down to 1990 when I became a member of the Seed Savers Exchange. We have a huge network now.
Yeah.
And there's over 3,500 members. And so many of the things which were listed, illustrated in that William Henry Miles seed catalog for 1913, I was able to locate through the Seed Savers. In other words, they were around all this time, but in the past you'd have no way of knowing that someone else had it, and they'd have no way of knowing that you were looking for it.
Right, right, right. When I was doing some research to prepare myself for this show, I was reminded of the market bulletins that Eudora Welty used to be a part of. As a Southern writer, Eudora Welty, she was big into gardening, her and her mom. And she kind of wrote a book and documented the correspondence about gardeners and the way that they talk back and forth, and they would send seeds and tips for growing. And this is really lovely that you are doing the same thing with your journals.
Well, back in those days, the farm journals or bureaus, bulletins, were really about the only way of communicating.
Right.
The rest of it was disjointed information. You might find some things in libraries, or it was really just pure luck in many cases, which I still rely on when saving seed. Someone will hear about me that I'm looking for something, or that I collect seed, and they'll send samples of it.
Uh-huh.
So some of it's real fine detective work. Others is pure luck.
Right.
But we do have, we're blessed today with the internets, and you can look up anything at all. So it's opened up a whole new world for seed savers and collectors, those that are working to preserve genetic diversity.
Right. So let's go back a little bit further prior and tell me about your art background and how you got into painting and drawing.
Well, I'll tell you what, I picked the two poorest occupations on the face of the earth, art and farming. You can't make a dime at either one. But then I wouldn't trade either one. It's the most rewarding life I could ever imagine. If I had to go back and do it again, that's the way I would do it. I had my first garden in 1954. My father showed me how to plant corn and potatoes in the side yard. And I remember the thrill of digging those new potatoes out of that rich earth.
Mm-hmm.
Those beautiful things, they're so tender that the skins fall off when you wash them.
Yeah.
Just wonderful. And, you know, I still, years and years later, I still have that enthusiasm. Every time I plant potatoes or go out, I still have that childlike enthusiasm of excitement of digging potatoes out of the ground or pulling a carrot up or a turnip, whatever it might be. It's just it's something that never leaves you.
Right, right.
It gets stamped into your DNA, and it's just a strong part of you.
Yeah. Yeah. So how did the art part come in? Were you always interested in painting and drawing?
Always was, since the first grade in school, when I was looking out the window and drawing pictures instead of paying attention to my lessons. It was hard getting me through 12 years of school. It took a lot of prodding and work.
Uh-huh. Well, now everybody's happy to have you on their alumni list, I'm sure. So you went to school up in Boston. Is that right? Or where did you get your art training?
That was graduate school. I went in printmaking, etching, lithography, mono printing, all the printmaking techniques.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. Well, it back in those days, you really could maybe make some money in art as in the printing end of things.
It was possible, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so I was very interested in the Henry Moll seed catalog that you were talking about. So I did a little research, and the Moll family was actually from Boston. Did you know that?
I know the company was located in Philadelphia, but I didn't realize they were from Boston.
Yeah, so they you know, are an old Pilgrim family, and then through the generations they kind of moved south. So I was interested in the kind of art background and the correspondence that you have between Tennessee and Massachusetts.
Well, I spent 16 years in Boston total.
Uh-huh.
I was thinking about the years I spent there. I was reading over your resume and how you love the city gardening and gardens and all sorts of projects like that. And it reminded me of the years I lived there. If there was a square inch somewhere with some soil in it, I had something growing in it.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. And that's, you know, my Tennessee roots kind of came out when I moved into New York City. I grew up kind of with a Southern daddy and Southern grandparents, and I didn't think much about it. It was just what we did until I moved to New York, and I thought, what's wrong with this place? They need some gardens. And I had grown up as a gardener, but I didn't think about it as a profession until I moved here. And I just wanted to make every little corner look great, you know, and I couldn't afford a studio. I too was a painter, and I couldn't afford a studio. I, you know, barely made any money. And I was working in galleries, and I realized, hey, you can actually make some money as a landscaper in New York because it's a niche industry. So I guess Tennessee never really escaped me. And my Aunt Linda always says, why don't you come down here and be a landscaper? And I say, Linda, you don't need landscapers down there. You need them up here in the city.
Yeah, it was already done a million years ago.
Exactly, exactly. And then tell me about the Louisiana trip and how that really changed your life, right?
It was a life-altering experience. I went there in 1973 the first time. A friend of mine from art school went down to visit her in the summer of 1973.
Uh-huh.
And the rest is history. I've spent many, many years going back there. I met a lot of the old farmers. At Washington Parish is a rural parish. It's located 70-some miles above New Orleans. It was a corn and cotton country back in the early days. But a lot of its rural roots are still intact, a lot of the old ways and things that I loved.
Right.
Plus, not only that, but old varieties of seed that I was able to collect.
Right.
But the history and the heritage and the way of life and the ways of farming, I have a good friend of mine, Mr. Arlie O'Brien, that's 97 years old now, and I've filled up books listening to his stories about plowing teams of mules.
Yeah.
And all of the things that they grew, and it's fascinating to me.
Right. And then, so you go back every year, right, and you continue your documentation, and how has the parish changed over the years?
In a lot of ways, to me, it hasn't changed much at all. Of course, with any place, there's new buildings and things.
Right.
But the basics of it, to me, have remained the same. It's a lot of the timber companies own, I think, approximately 40% of the parish, so a lot of it's in timberland, and the farms remain, and so it's very much unchanged, something that I like in this world today where everything's completely in turmoil and changing all the time. It's nice to have the stability of a sense of place and community and a way of life that's remained intact.
Right, right. So tell me about the Tennessee sweet potato pumpkin.
That was the first thing that I noticed in that William Henry Mile catalog. It's bell-shaped. It weighs about 25 pounds. It's white, has white skin and green mottling on it.
Uh-huh.
Green stripes. And I find, for years and years, I looked for that, and no one had heard of it or knew where it was, anything about it. But when I became a member of the Seed Savers Exchange, I found four listings for it. Well, I ordered all four listings, and I kept those seeds on my pillow till the following spring. Go to bed at night, I'd take a look at those seeds. First thing in the morning, wake up, look at those seeds. Couldn't wait for the planting season to get there.
Uh-huh.
And I remember I planted those up in the front yard, and they took over three-quarters of the front yard. That was great because I didn't have to mow that year.
So tell me, how does it taste?
Oh, it's heavenly. It does have somewhat of a sweet potato flavor. It's a yellow flesh. They're wonderful split in half and just baked the way they are.
Uh-huh.
Or for pies, they're unexcelled, have a wonderful taste.
Oh, nice.
Which is common with so many of your old varieties. They had such wonderful flavor. You see, we got it right the first time. We've spent the last 60-plus years taking all that taste out.
Right.
But
right.
We had it to start with, and people are rediscovering. And I think that's one of the wonderful things that's going on now. It's a true renaissance.
Uh-huh.
We're experiencing those old flavors. We know what a real tomato is in place of the styrofoam.
Right. The square.
Tomato with a styrofoam interior and a plastic skin.
Yeah, and the square tomato that University of Michigan developed, right?
They're square, all right. They have no flavor.
Exactly,
Tomato in name only.
Right, right. I think you probably also know Amy Goldman.
Yes, I do very well.
She's been on our show a couple times across the network, and I actually know her from my work at the Horticultural Society of New York a long time ago. She was a partial funder for my program. So,
well, she and her family are very big into the Seed Savers Exchange. They have the Goldman Library out in Decorah, Iowa, and they're big benefactors of the Seed Savers Exchange, so she's involved in many, many aspects of all of this.
And she married a Tennessee man, too.
Yes.
A conservationist.
Right. They've been down to Blackberry to visit.
Yes.
I've traded seeds with her, given her some different things that I have.
Uh-huh.
That's one thing with if you're around a seed saver, you don't get out of the house without some seed.
Exactly. Well, she actually gave me some tomato seeds last time she was here on our show. we were talking about her latest book, and I gave them to my brother in Connecticut, and he gave them to a bunch of neighbors. So we have, spread the seed far and wide on our end.
That's the wonderful thing about this movement.
Yeah.
You know, it's one thing to preserve things. If I have seeds, let's say a bag of beans of some type, and I keep them at the bottom of my freezer, they're saved, but they're what we refer to as functionally extinct. In other words, they're not out there for you or the general public or growers, someone that might want to enjoy those, a chef that might want to utilize them in his restaurant.
Right.
So we want to make these things available to people. That's what keeps them going, like you said about the tomato seed. Now, that's spread around, and they'll spread them around.
Right.
Your friends will. So it's a great way to help accomplish all these goals.
And it's a great way to just stay connected with your neighbor, to share food and share stories. And I think that's really what communities are about. And that's what's getting lost with, games on the internet and so much TV, and people are not talking to each other the way they used to, and meeting at the market, community market, and working with their hands in the soil. I'd like to read a quote from Eudora Welty, who I mentioned earlier, and she said, "I think that people have lost the working garden. We used to get down on our hands and our knees. The absolute contact between hand and the earth and the intimacy of it, that is the instinct of a gardener. People like to classify and categorize, and that takes away from the creativity. I think the artist, in every sense of the word, learns from what's individual, and that's where the wonder expresses itself." And I felt like that quote was so relevant to all of your work and the painting and the community aspect and the sharing of stories and the documentation of it.
I resemble that quote.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think it was made for you.
It couldn't be stated better.
She wrote it for you.
Accurate. She positively nailed it on that.
Exactly. So before we go to break, I just want to read one more kind of Southern author quote. And this was actually read at my wedding at the Museum of Appalachia. My brother read this because I have this kind of north-south life, and my husband actually has a north-south life. So my brother stood up and he read this quote, and it's very relevant. So it's Mark Twain, and he describes Southerners in particular who really know how to eat. "Fried chicken, roast pig, wild and tame turkeys, ducks and geese, venison just killed, squirrels, rabbits, pheasants, partridges, prairie chickens, homemade bacon and ham, hot biscuits, hot batter cakes, hot buckwheat cakes, hot wheat bread, hot rolls, hot corn, fresh corn boiled on the ear, succotash, butter beans, string beans, tomatoes, peas, Irish potatoes, sweet potatoes, buttermilk, sweet milk, clabber, watermelons, muskmelons, cantaloupe, all fresh from the garden, apple pie, peach pie, pumpkin pie, apple dumplings, peach cobbler. I can't remember the rest. The way that certain things were cooked was perhaps the main splendor, particularly a certain few of the dishes. For instance, the cornbread, the hot biscuits, and wheat bread, and the fried chicken. These things have never been properly cooked in the North. In fact, no one there is able to learn the art, so far as my experience goes. The North thinks it knows how to make cornbread, but this is gross superstition. Perhaps no bread in the world is quite as good as Southern cornbread, and perhaps no bread in the world is quite so bad as the Northern imitation of it."
Well, that's true, too.
Only Mark Twain, right?
So Marcy, I'm about to faint from hunger. I'm going to have to go make a snack during the break.
All right. We are going to take a break. When we come back, let's talk about some Southern staples, John, and some tips for some of these seeds that you've been saving. Take a break. And
wonderful. Look forward to it.
We'll be right back on We Dig Plants. Thank you.
I went down to North Carolina. Realized there was surely nothing finer.
Hey, it's Kathy Irway, the host of Eat Your Words. Today I'm here with Camilla Salisbury, author of Bob's Red Mill Everyday Gluten-Free Cookbook, 281 Delicious Whole Grain Recipes. We're going to get to the bottom of this gluten-free craze. So why aren't people eating gluten, and what does gluten-free really mean?
Well, there are two main reasons why people are deciding to go gluten-free these days. And the first one is really serious. It's for people who have celiac disease, and it's a pretty serious condition. But then there is also a growing number of people with gluten intolerance or gluten sensitivity, and they're trying out gluten-free diets because they find that eating foods without gluten just makes them feel better.
Okay, got it. But what actually makes something gluten-free?
Well, what makes something gluten-free is essentially that it doesn't have any of the protein, gluten, in it. And a lot of people are surprised to learn that many grains do not contain gluten, when in fact just a very small number of grains do.
Does anyone offer truly gluten-free options?
Well, Bob's Red Mill really understands gluten-free options, and that means they separate their grains during the manufacturing process, and so they're testing each batch at every step of the way for purity to ensure that it's gluten-free. So when it says on the package that it's gluten-free, you can be assured that it is gluten-free.
All right, so gluten-free listeners out there craving some steel-cut oats can pick up a pack of Bob's Red Mill and rest assured you're getting the real deal. Learn more about Bob's Red Mill and all the gluten-free products that they offer at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
Hi, welcome back. We are talking today on We Dig Plants with the gardener and seed saver, John Kuykendall of Blackberry Farm. So before the break, we just talked about some food and the fact that Southerners are probably the best food cooks, I think. I mean, although you cannot get, you know, a lobster roll in the North is always going to be on top of my list. But butter beans from the South are one of the Southern staples. Let's talk a little bit about butter beans and some varieties that you recommend and growing and any tips that you have.
Well, you just hit on one of my favorite topics. I love butter beans. And people will often ask, what is a butter bean? Well, butter beans are the lima family, or lima for Peru. Peru's the center of origin, where the crop originated, just as the Andes Mountain for potatoes. Not Ireland. We always call them Irish potatoes.
Right.
America is the center of origin for that.
Exactly.
The colorful types are the ones that we generally refer to as butter beans, the speckled butter beans.
Mm-hmm.
There's different colors, different modeling. When I first started collecting butter beans, I thought, or limas, there is no difference. They're all limas. Butter beans, the old Southern term that refers to the speckled types,
mm-hmm.
generally. When I first started, I thought limas are green. Everybody knows the green lima. But little did I realize until I became a seed saver that they literally range in color all the way from solid white to solid black, with every color in between. Mm-hmm. I have one that I'm very favorites. It's called Red Calico. It's a beautiful red, bright red butter beans. Some of them are bright red with black modeling on them. But
mm-hmm.
that one dates to 1794, and I can't think of a better way of illustrating history and heritage. This has been passed down in a Tennessee family since that year. They can document it back to 1794. And butter beans have slightly different flavor to me. They're more like, if I had to make a comparison, I might think of the difference between, let's say a red bean, red kidney bean, and a green lima. A little more of an earthy flavor.
Mm-hmm.
The green limas have a distinct taste, but these are a little more beany or earthy flavored. But they are so wonderful, and they're great fresh. what we call green shell. In other words, when they're immature and shelled out in the green shell stage, and also dried for winter. They're so prolific, such prolific producers. And one thing about especially those old varieties, many of the ones that I have still exhibit their wild trait, and that's shattering. Shattering is when a seed pod busts apart and disperses the seed out. Now, a modern lima, you have to pry it open. It's become totally dependent. It's been bred for modern consumption, and the hulls are different.
Right.
But the old ones, they still retain that wild ancestral trait of shattering. If you touch one that's dried, it'll pop open, and the seed will pop out on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But they were what we might refer to as a 365-day-a-year crop. These beans were prolific. They would last. You would have them in abundance during the summer months. And as the season went on, they would start to dry quicker than you could pick them. So you not only have next year's seed source, you also have an abundance of beans for winter use, dried beans. So but that's what we mean when we say a 365-day-a-year crop. In those early years, people, when they were totally dependent on what they raised on the farm, just about everything had to be a 365-day-a-year crop in some form.
Right.
Either canned, dried, or the fresh use.
Mm-hmm.
But one of my favorite recipes for it is, learned one of the ladies in Washington Parish taught me, is cook them. She said one of the reasons they were called butter beans is they'd be cooked in some good, rich butter, what the old-timers referred to as cow salve butter, in other words, the real thing, and some whole milk. And it is a wonderful, rich recipe.
Mm-hmm.
Other ways, they'll use streaked meat, bacon that's browned down, and cook them that way.
Mm-hmm.
But they're good to me just about any way you do them.
Yep. Yeah, my mom and my grandma does it just with butter and milk, and it's almost mushy, they're so soft in your mouth, and you know, some salt, and it's the one vegetable that my son will eat.
He likes butter beans.
He likes butter beans. Yeah, that's about it. So, and only when my grandma or when my mom makes them. He doesn't like them. I guess I don't cook them enough. So I guess I got to work on that. My grandmother would be shaking her finger at me, I'm sure.
Well, that's a good start anyway.
Yeah, yeah. So let's talk about blackberries and blackberries on the farm, right?
The very best blackberries that you can get, to me, are the wild ones, the one you find in pastures, fence lines, along
right.
the road. They have that wonderful, heavenly, sweet flavor and rich blackberry taste that you don't find in the larger sorts that you get. They have thornless blackberries now, but they have, to me, they're kind of watery and lack taste and full of big old seeds.
Uh-huh.
You put one berry in your mouth and you've got a whole mouthful of seed
right.
that you're trying to get rid of.
Uh-huh.
But the wild ones, I have such vivid memories of blackberry cobblers during the late summer when we'd be cutting tobacco. They'd come in for dinner noon.
Yep.
And blackberry cobbler would always be on the table among so many other things. But that is just, it's a heavenly flavor that you won't get with the modern types.
Right. Right. And do you guys, are they wild on the farm? I'm assuming that's how the farm got named.
It was. The original builders, the lady, legend tells us that she was walking along and she got a blackberry bramble stuck on her stockings,
uh-huh.
tore stockings, and so she named it Blackberry Farm.
Okay. And when did the farm get started? What's the history of the farm?
Well, Blackberry Farm goes all the way back to 1939. The modern era, the Bell family and Sam Bell, who had the vision for the farmstead and all of that, that's just a little over 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the new part. We have the culinary barn.
Right.
And we have the dairy. We have the cheese making.
Mm-hmm.
The butcher shop.
Mm-hmm.
We have the preservation kitchens where the blackberries made into jellies, jams, all sorts of preserves.
Right.
Anything from the farm that's in excess, we use there.
Mm-hmm.
And in ramp season, they even make ramp kimchi out of the leaves.
Oh, wow. I wanted to talk to you about ramps. Tell me about ramps. You guys must be pretty busy in ramp season, I would imagine.
Yes, it is. They come in. They generally grow at around 4,000 feet. Now, they will grow lower, but I think that they were cleaned out long ago down where it was easy to get to them.
Uh-huh.
We have purveyors that come in, people that go up in the mountains and pick those. But they're very, very popular now. They pickle the ramps. They make any number of recipes and things that
yeah.
include in the culinary process. It's funny to think back on them, you know, and you've probably heard yourself in the early years. I've even seen a photograph of a child sitting out in a chair outside the classroom, and they've got a little sign on them that says ramp eater. The things have such a horrible smell, and it's kind of like garlic.
Yeah.
And so these have a really, really strong, distinct smell. But today, it's come full circle. They're very, very sought after, very popular.
Yeah.
It's very much like collards, too. You know, collards was once thought of as a poverty food.
Right.
But now, just about every chef loves them. They're extremely high in nutrients, very, very good for you.
Right.
And kale was once something you put the steak on top of, but today it's used in so many ways.
It's
great to see all these things coming back and having a place at the table again.
Yeah, it's T-shirt marketing now, right? Got kale?
Yes, got kale.
So, and I know also that at the farm, they're doing truffles, right? And they're inoculating?
We have a truffle orchard now.
Uh-huh.
Have 150 hazelnut shrubs, and they have been inoculated for the Paragora truffle, the black truffle.
Right.
And they will take anywhere from 10, 12 years to come into
right.
to production. And right. there's no guarantee at that.
Right, right.
We have those going, and we also have the Lagotto Romagnolo dogs, the Italian breed that's around 800 years old.
Right.
They brought those over, and they've trained a number of those. So that's part of the program as well.
Yeah. Well, let me also tell you, John, that I met my husband because I have a coonhound who looks just like Smokey. and he was from Tennessee, and I was so tired of everybody in New York saying, "Is that just a big beagle?" And I thought, oh my gosh, you know, and then lo and behold, this man says, "That dog looks just like Smokey." And I thought, who are you? And we ended up getting married. And then we had a blue tick, and now we have a red bone. So I was wondering, though, if you could, I was hoping maybe they would start training coonhounds, you know, because of their nose, and the bloodhounds to do some truffle hunting.
That hasn't happened as far as I know, but Jim right. Sanford, who runs the program there, he said any dog could be trained to do that.
Yeah, yeah,
but,
yeah.
But this breed is so well known for it, and they've done it over centuries.
Right.
That's what they've gone with.
Right, right. And the Kushaw melon, right? Let's talk about the Kushaw melon. That's an old variety that's not in circulation so much. Do you guys grow that?
Yes, we do. Kushaw is very commonly grown in the cornfield along with the Kentucky Field tan pumpkins. There's
uh-huh.
one that they have up in New York called Long Island Cheese, the tan ones.
Uh-huh.
Those, that's out of that same class, and that's the Kentucky Field class, or the Machada class. Butternuts are in that class.
Right, right.
But the Kushaw was brought to America in 1700 from one of the Caribbean islands, and that was took on it to became very popular in the South. It's somewhat similar to the Tennessee sweet potato pumpkin.
Uh-huh.
And it's very, very good for pies, very good baked. And it's also a good keeper. Those tan pumpkins will keep. I've still got one up at the shed, garden shed blackberries, which was grown last year, harvested last September. And it's still solid. They had to rely on things like that. The shells were harder, the skin, and it was a good keeper because they relied on that to last through the winter months and on into the season until the next harvest began to come in.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. The history that you have in your head, these journals that you've documented are amazing. And we have to talk about the film and the journals. The film is called Deeply Rooted, and it was produced and written by Christina Melton, and it's Louisiana Public Broadcasting. It's going to be screened at the Denver Slow Food Conference July 14th and 15th. The screening is actually going to be on the 15th at 3 p.m. You can get tickets at slowfoodnations.com. But tell me a little bit about the movie and how you met Christina and some of the farmers that are profiled from Louisiana and that whole process.
Christina Melton was a godsend, a real stroke of good fortune. I was working at the shed one day, sorting out some seeds, and she came in with her husband and another couple from Baton Rouge. And I always ask guests where they come from. Many times you strike up conversations, and you might even know someone from that area. And she told me that she produced documentaries, and I happened to have some of my drawing books there with the stories in it and the illustrations, and she looked at that, and she took pictures of them. And she took those back and showed her friend, who's the editor-in-chief at LSU Press.
Uh-huh.
And she said, well, we've got to do something with this. We need to publish this. And so that got the ball rolling on that. She then became interested in doing a documentary with all of that. And that's what happened in 2015. They filmed part of it up at Blackberry Farm. And then the second half was done down in Louisiana, Washington Parish. And
uh-huh.
So we showed the old seeds, told a lot of the old stories. We just spent a lot of time in the field filming those crops and how they were grown and everything about them we could do.
Right.
And then we also, down in Louisiana, we interviewed a bunch of the old people, too. They were part of it.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And so it's going to be released this fall, I believe. The film will... it'll be nationally distributed to public televisions this summer for fall 2017 airing. And I was talking with Christina just about, you know, there's the possibility of a book project too, right? That would be available in maybe fall 2018.
That's true. That book is it's well underway.
Uh-huh. Well, I can't. Your drawings looked amazing in the little promo piece that she sent me. I'm so excited to see it and to read those stories. And thank you for all of your work over these years. Who knew that it would culminate in all of this?
You know, one other thing you asked about how that came to be.
Uh-huh.
Until Christina came along, I had no idea how in this world I could ever possibly get that out. I knew that I wanted to preserve those things. In the beginning, they were just small five-and-dime store spiral notebooks that you can fit in your pocket.
Right.
And they're just scribbled down notes.
Uh-huh.
I hadn't begun to refine it in any way. I knew that what I was hearing was something I wanted to say, but I didn't want it to get lost. But I remember about 7 years ago, that one of the ladies... where I'm a volunteer down at the Washington Parish Free Fair. They have a pioneer settlement called Mile Branch, and it's historic buildings from all over the parish. And I cook in a log cabin kitchen on a wood-burning stove. And one of the volunteer ladies, she had seen these books over the years, always showed them to her. She said, John, don't let this get away from you. Do something with this. Get this published so people can
right.
benefit from it.
Right, right. It's the most important information. Right. Right. I mean, this is like, you know, Smithsonian worthy. Like, this is really, really lost history and these stories. And it's so important that, and I'm so glad that, you know, that it's going to be out there in the public kind of base of knowledge, you know?
One thing that I've tried to do in all of these journals when I'm interviewing these old people is to write it exactly as it's spoken.
Uh-huh.
In other words, the vernacular, the dialect, the usage of it.
Right.
Much of it, you'll find old English terms in it, different words and
right.
phrases and
right.
things. Like one of my old friends, he was talking about a little dream down from the edge of his field. Dreams means a drain or a little stream that comes out
right.
hillside.
Right.
And they'd say, nary for none and nary for nara.
Yeah, yeah.
Hit for it. People used to think, I remember when I was growing up, they thought that was just people that were uneducated. What they were speaking was Elizabethan English, a lot of the old terms and words, exactly as you see written in Chaucer.
Exactly, exactly. And that's, you know, it reminded me when I was reading about you and your work and that you do these storytelling events at Blackberry Farm, and it reminded me of when I spent some time in Ireland, the old storytellers that would be in the pub, and it was a great community kind of organizer, and we would all sit around and listen to these old Irish folk tales, and that's exactly, you know, what these farmers are talking about, is the old ways and the myths and the traditions, and that is just becoming obsolete in our fast pace. And that's why I'm so grateful for all of your work over the number of years. It's really lovely, and that you combined art and storytelling and agriculture. It's just so rich.
Well, I'm so thankful it's coming back. I want to tell you one I think you'll get a kick out of. I just happened to be browsing through Facebook the other day, and something popped up on the screen. It said, the trouble with the world today is nobody's sitting on the front porch breaking beans with grandma anymore.
That is, you know,
I like that one.
Yeah, that is exactly, we, you know, when I go home to my parents, that's, you know, my son is there shucking the corn and breaking the beans. And I, that's why we go home. You know, that's what I want. I want him to understand those things. And it's not just the new fad of country music or bluegrass music. You know, it's that time spent with your elders and the experience that they pass down.
And what can be passed on, it's amazing.
Exactly.
That's oral history, for the parts you were talking about, oral history, how that's passed down.
Exactly, exactly. So let me just tell again the name of the documentary film is called Deeply Rooted, and it's going to be screened at the Denver Slow Food Conference, July 15th. Get tickets at slowfoodnations.com. And again, it was produced and written by Christina Melton and Louisiana Public Broadcasting. Well, John, once again, it's been a pleasure to talk to you and to hear a little bit about some of these varieties, and I'm sure you have a lot more in your repertoire that's going to come out in the movie and the book.
Well, I tell you what, I always like the opportunity to preach the seed gospel.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for joining us and for all of your work again. And I really can't wait. My husband and I are trying to figure out a time to come to Blackberry and spend a weekend there. We're approaching our 15th wedding anniversary, so we thought we would perhaps spend it at Blackberry.
Well, we will sure look forward to seeing you.
Yeah, I will look you up if I come.
Wonderful. I appreciate it.
All right, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to We Dig Plants on Heritage Radio Network, and we'll be back next week with our Zone 7 show. And thanks for listening, and see you in the garden.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.